I think this young guy bias is a lot of bunk, speaking for the old people out there. You know, there's something to it. I'm not going to dismiss all of it, and the ability to connect, and you certainly connect maybe a bit differently, maybe better, maybe not. I don't think it's all for the better, but when you're younger versus as you get older. But as far as staying up with the game and current, that's all a bunch of hogwash.
Ladies and gentlemen, Zebra Stripes Podcast. I am Coach Gene Clemens. Thank you for joining me and Coach Witt once again this week, talking a little bit of everything. You know, it's been a really interesting week in sports, and we back. We're back to give it to y'all. Coach Witt, what's up, man? How you doing?
Doing great. How are you today?
You know, we're making it happen. We're making it happen.
Hey, belated happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah. You ever feel bad about missing someone's birthday?
You know, there on occasion, every once in a while, I miss a birthday. And when I do, I apologize profusely for it. Because, you know.
I'm apologizing to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. No apology necessary. I understand, you know, life is always busy, and it's not, it hasn't been the most, like, you know, Hollywood birthday in the world. So, but I'm happy to see another year. Happy to be here. For those out there, whenever you're listening to this, we are recording this on March 7th. So my birthday is March 6th. If any of you want to send me presents next year, just lock it into your calendar. March 6th, 2023, present for Coach Clemens. I really would appreciate it. But, you know, I'm not the only one that's, you know, that's cooking. Me and Shaq, you know, we share a birthday as well. So, you know, all the greats. Lots of similarities between Shaq and I as well, you know, so. Very gregarious personalities, you know, larger than life, if you would. So birthdays are interesting, especially as you get older. As obviously you know, you put different things in perspective, and I'm just happy. I'm happy to see another one, and I'm ready to try to make the next one the best one.
Well, the more you change, the more things stay the same. So
there you go. You know what is not changing, or excuse me, what is changing, and that's Duke's head basketball coach. Duke's head coach is going to change for the first time in a billion years, at the end of this season, whenever that season ends for Duke. Coach Krzyzewski, the legend, probably, you know, number two, maybe in some people's book, number one, depending upon how they look at it. But I think a lot of people still have Wooden as number one. And, you know, Krzyzewski rolling in there probably as a solid 1A, 1B, if not, you know, coming for him, especially with what you deal with in the modern game today. I was thinking about it because we were kind of sort of touching on it at the end about, you know, South Carolina women's basketball, and we'll get back to that in a second. But you had said, hey, you know, maybe that's the thing for Krzyzewski and the run, you know, with them losing to Duke. And I was like, yeah, I don't know if they have the same level of team. But then it got me thinking about the fact that when Krzyzewski retired, he's essentially handing the reins over to John Shire. And while I think, you know, anybody that he's hired, he's clearly given a lot of thought to. And I was surprised by the move. I thought that there were some other guys who are more well-established coaches who've had success, who understand this world, who are intimately involved as far as their love and their support of Duke basketball, who could have come back and taken over that reins. I would argue that some of these guys left to get from underneath Coach K so that they would have a better chance of coming back and getting, you know, that job. And clearly I'm talking about Dawkins. I'm talking about Amaker, two guys who are well-respected in the coaching ranks and who I believe would have done a fantastic job continuing on that legacy that Coach Krzyzewski has put forth, you know, with the help of all of the people who've been with him those years. But those guys didn't get the nod. No Jeff Capel, no Wojo, obviously. No James. It was John Shire. And that seemed odd to me. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I was surprised a little bit. I mean, I think the top two seemingly on the board were definitely Amaker and Dawkins, I think, guys that were pivotal, instrumental in getting that thing off the ground and have had each a lot of success where they've been at. So, I mean, I was surprised, but I don't think you ever know what's going to really happen in coaching searches and whether or not, you know, they were rewarding the guy who's just there on staff now, thinking that's the best form of continuity. No idea. I've read a few things about it, but, I think there's going to be continuity of some type at Duke, no matter, you know, as long as they hired anyone of note, there's going to be a certain level of continuity. Sometimes you forget Duke was pretty good before Coach K got there too. So it's not like he invented the game of basketball at Duke. I think most people would say that was a surprising hire. Now maybe some would say, good for the guys that didn't get it, because, you know, can always be difficult following a legend. So maybe they're, each of them might be one removed from the job. You know, let someone not do quite as well first before you go back and take that one on. Kind of like Roy did before, headed back to UNC.
Yeah, I think the interesting part is I wonder how age played a factor with the fact that Shire at 35, I believe, somewhere around there, 35, 36 years old, a rather young coach to be able to kind of grow with the game as the game has evolved. Maybe people, the decision makers thought that Dawkins' style wasn't one that was befitting of what they wanted to see go beyond. Maybe they thought Amaker hadn't recruited for a while, you know, hasn't recruited at a high enough level of athlete coming, you know, having to recruit the Ivy League. I don't know. It felt different only because of the experience of Shire. Like, you're asking a lot of a guy to come in with no head coaching experience and take over arguably the most well-known program in the country. That's difficult. So, and maybe it is a situation where you're like, yeah, you know, let one get away. But I'm pretty sure both of those guys would have signed up for the task if given.
You know, yeah, I think you're right. I think this young guy bias is a lot of bunk, speaking for the old people out there. There's something to it. I'm not going to dismiss all of it, and the ability to connect, and you certainly connect maybe a bit differently, maybe better, maybe not. I don't think it's all for the better, but when you're younger versus as you get older. But as far as staying up with the game and current, that's all a bunch of hogwash. I would say, if anything, the more experienced coaches are probably more open, flexible, adaptive, evolving all the time, understand the importance of it. I think the younger guys, what they might have is a blind trust in the little bit that they do know. So maybe they got a little more juice with the little bit they know. But I just think there's a, you know, we're living in an age, obviously, of fresh new faces, fresh new everything. Young is good. You know, women have dealt with it forever, but we're not going to get back on that subject. But I think it's both Amaker and Dawkins, I mean, those guys had hit the ground running, because the recruiting at the high major level is really, in my estimation, easier than at lower levels, because at the lower levels, you are sifting through more. And in the case of Amaker, you're, you know, dealing with an Ivy League dynamic of grades and indexes that you need to meet as far as the academics goes. And at the higher major level, you're selecting as much as you're recruiting. You know, and that's why I've often said some of the D3 guys, the guys that have to start out looking at everybody, eventually turn out to be some of the best coaches, because they've had to really recruit the whole gamut.
Yeah, I mean, I think the part of age that really I was referring to is the opportunity to grow with the position. Like, if you're trying to get another Krzyzewski, like if you're trying to, he's just been there for a billion years, you're not looking to hire a coach to fire a coach. Shire gives you the best opportunity as a younger coach to get 20 plus years out of. Is Johnny Dawkins coaching for the next 20 years? Is Tommy Amaker coaching for the next 20 years? Possibly. I mean, but maybe.
Well, I think back to your point, I think you're trying to get the best coach for the position. I think it would be rather crazy to think about, well, we want the next Coach K. Well, that's ludicrous. Or we want someone for 20 years. Hey, you don't. Maybe you'll have him for 20 years. Maybe you won't. So I don't think you want anywhere. I don't think you're looking to hire someone for too short a term, right? But the reality is, coaches jump around. Probably less so at some of those pristine jobs, for sure.
Where do you go from Duke?
Yeah, well, you go to the NBA, maybe, if that's your bent, right? I mean, you know, or you sign even a bigger contract somewhere else, as in some of these sports, you know, with the money changing hands, some of these schools will, you know, sign guys to bigger and bigger contracts. So I just don't think you're looking too long term. That's not the way the world works. I think you got to be, you know, I'm not sure what a, you know, 5 year, maybe 5 to 7 years, what you should be looking at. Who's the best guy for the job? And speaking of which, I think you made me think earlier about, you know, Coach K. I agree with you. You know, he's probably 1A or 1B or number two behind Wooden. I think that's where people would have him. But I was thinking to myself, you know, Wooden would be one in the old era, which I think is fair. You know, he coached a different era. I like Red Auerbach, you know, so I equate, Wooden and Auerbach as the two of that era. But, you know, in the modern era, Coach K is number one. I'm not sure who's number one in the modern era of pro hoops. We might have to look at that for a second too. So, and I almost think it's really, you know, same old thing when you start measuring players from different generations and eras. It's just conversation, because you can't really do it. The games were different. I mean, Auerbach was running the same six plays. That's not happening today in the NBA, I don't think. Wooden really wasn't.
They're running plays in the NBA?
Huh? Yeah.
Come on, plays?
Come on. Stop dissing on the NBA.
Come on, Whit. Like, let's be real about it. Let's be real about it. And I don't want to get off of this, but I think we touched on something that's really interesting. Number one, if we're saying that Shire, that all of the stuff with Young and everything is hogwash and experience is hogwash, why in the hell did they give Shire this job? Like, that's what I'm really just, I don't understand. And you don't have an answer to it. So we're just putting it out there in the ether. Like, why the hell did he get this job?
I don't have a good answer. My best answer is he was the one that happened to be there at the time, you know, and maybe if Wojo, you know, happened to, you know, be there at the time, maybe he's the guy. So timing is everything sometimes. I think what you have to be a little bit afraid of, which is the experience that Mike Hopkins has had at Washington, which is to say he was the heir apparent to Boeheim, you know, 6 years ago, whatever it was, when it looked like Boeheim would retire then. Now I think Jimmy's going to coach until he's about 95. He's probably going to outlive them all. You know, and Hopkins is probably going to be out of a job. So, you know, a guy that, you know, simply got tired of waiting left and, you know, may or may not be the next guy, because I saw Boeheim this week say they do have a plan. They do have a plan. I mean, what he didn't say is that plan.
That could be the same thing that was said about Woj, right? I mean, Woj sat around for a long time next to Krzyzewski before he decided to take that job with Marquette. Didn't have a bad run of it at Marquette. I think Marquette may have gotten him out of there a year too early. Don't know how he related. You know what I'm saying? I don't know all the insides or whatever, but it could be said that that's the case, but at the end of the day, like, it's just an interesting. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall. However it was going down, I would have loved to have been in the room.
Yeah, me.
The other thing that you talked about was
we're going to have to buy the book. We're going to have to buy the book.
There's going to be a book. Somebody's writing a book for sure.
Yeah.
By the way, what's the advance? What's the money that Coach K would command? Would be able to command for a memoir?
Yeah, no idea.
If we're talking, what was it, like something like 20, 30 million for Obama's, we got to be talking right up there with Obama, right? Because more people care about sports than they do about the president's life that has been mostly public, you know?
I don't like memoirs anyway. You know, give me a slice of life. I don't want the whole enchilada. The problem with the memoirs, it's too much there and maybe not enough detail because it's covering too much. Give me a slice. Give me the final season. Give me the early years. Give me the rivalry with Tobacco Road. Don't give me the whole, I don't need to. If I want to go back and read about West Point, I will. I mean, put the book out, but I'm not going to buy it.
Gotcha. So you didn't read A Promised Land. You didn't read,
I'm similar to being sorry about your birthday. It's on my reading list and has yet to be read. So, with that shot that is deserved here, I will get that done now that I have some time in the postseason.
Yeah, no, because you suggested a book to me and I literally downloaded it on the spot. Yeah. And read through it. I love it. You know what I'm saying? We're just finding out so much about each other. It's great. NBA.
It's great for one of us.
NBA. So you really think they're running plays in the NBA?
I do.
You do? How often?
Yes.
If you gave it a percentage, how often would you say plays are being run?
I would tell you more than 50% of the time and probably upwards of 75%. And then it might depend on two things. One, stage of the season they're at. Two, certainly philosophy of the coach. You know, flow gets its name. Flow is the modern motion, if you will, and gets its name from the NBA. And, even within the flow game of, let's say, read and react. There are different versions of it with rules and patterns that, it's not quite as unscripted as many would imagine it to be. That's not to say that there aren't, like ISO teams, ISO ball, nights when maybe they're not calling as much. I get it. But to just say it's a bunch of guys out there playing pickup is just...
Well, I look at it as comparative to the games below it. I think there are systems in place, right? But when I look at a guy come down and he calls for a screen, then he dribbles off the screen and then does whatever he does, is that a play or is that just part of the overall philosophy of what they do?
I'm going to say it's both, and good for you, because the bottom line is that's where I was going to go next. I mean, the bottom line is what's changed in the NBA is that more of the plays come initiate with a, two-man game, which is the pick and roll. So that's driving the NBA because it's the fastest, and not just the NBA, but also Europe, where there's 24 seconds clock, because it's the fastest way to trigger an offensive attack, to create an advantage, since that's the objective of offense, is to create an advantage and then capitalize with the best possible shot you can. So the easiest, fastest, bestest way to do that is with the screen, and is with the screen, and then all of the said plays might come off of the different options of that, of which are too long to, you know, go over in an hour. So I'm saying those are plays. They're just not old school plays. They're not plays for your father and grandfather, you know.
So they're not, they're more of plays that just, they're more if then statement plays than they are, this is exactly what you do every single time down.
I'm going to say they're, it's more akin to RPO in football.
Okay.
So teams that run a heavy dose of RPO in football, old school coaches, I mean, come on, that doesn't even resemble, you know, so it's fundamentally different than, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, you know, so
that's what coaches, old school coaches.
I wasn't talking about you, by the way. I wasn't taking a shot at you with that.
Oh yeah. No problem, because I'm in all of it. So it's like old school coaches would tell you that RPOs aren't new. So can the same thing be said about the way offense is being conducted now in Europe? Is it just a repurposing or regurgitation of offense that came before that we've now rebranded and repackaged? I think that's kind of what you were alluding to earlier.
Well, I would say you're right. I don't know if I was going there. I was just saying, making a statement of where things are. But yeah, I think things do tend to run in cycles like that, and I think basketball and football have that in common as well, where things come into style and go out of style. Sometimes it's because someone has success with something, you know.
Are you surprised that teams still allow you to get that same alley-oop playoff that you've been getting off for like 15, 20 years now? Like, are you surprised that teams still fall into that same trap where the guy passes it back up to the top and floats a little bit? Guy comes off the bottom screen, comes around and sets the back screen, and all of a sudden the Wolverdome's going crazy. Because I saw that play coming like the moment that it hit, and I don't coach against you every single year.
Right. Well, yeah. You know what? I was kind of just pretty happy that mid possession our team was able to actually get into it and run it and successfully. So. That was neat, but I mean that's zone offensive play number one of choice by most coaches that aren't necessarily excited about seeing a ton of zone in front of them. So mm-hmm. We all know that if you best way to get someone out of a zone who's not fully committed to it is to dunk on their head, you know, and then see how committed they are to running that zone when, you know, the entire gym erupts or, you know, it's a big momentum play. So yeah, that says less about the play than it does about the defense, right? So, you know, if you're not as committed zone defensive team, then you're always susceptible to some type of set play. And I'd be lying if I didn't say on some of the – I'm not a zone guy, but, you know, there's been once or twice someone's done something to us, and I just say, God darn, you got to eat it. But, you know, I'd feel worse if – that's something we practiced all the time defensively, and then all of a sudden they set a couple screens, like you said, and dunked in their head. I actually thought you were saying it about the, you know, the in style pick and roll dunk that you're seeing at every level, or at least levels where people can play above the rim, where the screener is rolling to the basket, and for one reason or another, sometimes getting a screen in what they call Spanish pick and roll, but oftentimes just going naked to the rim and getting a dunk. And you say, like, how in the world is that happening all the time? But the reality is because the three-point shot threat has defenses more and more spread out. So when that roller has any type of advantage because the defense is hedged out on the guard, on the ball handler, then he's got a head start to the rim. John Calipari, obviously at the college level, made it really famous within the dribble drive, you know, a decade ago.
Yeah, and then obviously there are just certain guys who are just way better at setting you up for it. There's just certain point guards who just have a knack for drawing you in at just the right time, and boom, if they've got a rim runner, that guy's going to get, you know, 12 points, you know, a night just because they know how to attack. That's interesting because I always
Steve Nash and what's his name? Steve Nash and, you know, with D'Antoni and well, yeah, but I mean, how about Nash and then who?
Amari Stoudemire.
Yeah. I mean, you know, seven seconds or less, right? Made a lot of what we're talking about very popular.
Yeah, but I think that all goes back to the old Paul Westhead, you know, type of, you know, just get the hell up the field, up the court, and boom, 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 and make something happen.
Yeah, so I would say the modern NBA then is kind of a blend of that. I mean, depending on the night you go, right? Because the NBA is not always running at breakneck speed like Westhead was, just like Rick Pitino tried to go in and press like the college does. And, you know, over 80 games, you can't do that. Over 80 games, you might not be able to go the pace of what Westhead was doing. But essentially, right, a modern attack might be run the way Westhead ran, and then with nothing – immediately get into some type of ball screen action, which I haven't studied Fred Hoiberg, but I have a feeling that that's what, you know, Hoiberg did with his time in college, then in the pros, now back in college.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to be a breakneck pace kind of guy. I think that you can easily find out what you're going up against based off whether or not they want to play that style.
I like that. Have you figured out that I'm going into my X and O mode because I'm suffering the start of withdrawal. So all of a sudden now I'm vomiting out my basketball guts to you, and our listeners have to suffer through this.
Well, I think the truth is our listeners are these kind of nerds. So, you know, we are talking to family right now. We are talking to people who are into this type of thing. And it's really interesting because when you look at the 54 points that LeBron James put up the other night, you know, with the Lakers, you look at the 54 that got put up in Cincinnati. I mean, not Cincinnati, in Boston. I don't know why I said Cincinnati for. In Boston. I don't like, there's not a lot of setting up. That was a lot of, I'm just way better at basketball than you guy that's guarding me. And so I'm going to get a nice amount of points just because I'm in the right spot at the right time. And this is an easy bucket. I'm going to get some stuff on the break. And then once I feel a few of them go down, all of a sudden the 1% takes over, and now I'm making shots from the logo. I'm fading away, hitting shots I have no business making, but I'm hot now. And so that once that heat's on, it's just a matter about time and opportunity. And as long as the team is giving you opportunity and you've got time on the clock, there are points going in the board.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure Oscar Robertson could have scored 54 in Cincinnati with the Royals too, so.
Yeah,
so you don't have to rule out 54 in Cincinnati from a historical perspective because the Big O was good for it. Interestingly, and you're talking about I'm just better than you and this and that. I mean, I didn't watch the game because I was doing some different things. But I mean, Tatum scored his 54 off of Durant, or they were guarding each other quite a bit from reports that I read. So. You know, I think there's a, you know, teammates have to let you kind of alluded to it, but if you're going to put up 54, you know, teammates have to find the hot hand. They're complicit in that. They're willing because, you know, if it's my turn, your turn, then, you know, it's not going to be 54. But if people recognize someone's got it going, then, you know, I agree with you. That's what, you know, that there's a bunch of factors that go into it, and the basket does get large. So, But I would say not all 54 created equal, like we were talking about before we got on air. You know, LeBron scores 54 because right now you've got a desperate team and he's more than capable, and he probably doesn't want to do that more than he has to, A, to just tire himself out, but B, to build the team concept. But I mean, there comes a point and you say, well, shit, I got to do something. So he goes out and scores 54. So I was telling you, I think Tatum's 54 was a better 54, more meaningful 54, has actually more long-term positive consequences than LeBron's 54.
Yeah, okay, I'm gonna challenge that. And here's why. Here's why. I think that Tatum's 54 is actually the problem. Because,
well, first of all, wait, stop. Before, okay. if we were going to say 3 months ago it was the problem, then I might agree with you. But for a team that's won 15 out of 17 and guarding and this and that, problem is the wrong word to use.
No, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to explain why, and feel free to hold on to all of that. And if you don't agree, I'm okay with that.
I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Earlier in the year, I think beginning of the year, we said that, I said, and I think you to a large extent agree, that We have to be careful with how we're labeling Tatum. We thought Tatum was supposed to be the mega star, and it could just be that he's just a piece. But it's now become a regular thing that when Tatum goes up against these elite level guys, the Durants, the Antetokounmpos, anytime that there's a marquee matchup there, Tatum goes bananas, which tells me if you have an ability to do that, I need that from you every night. I don't need 54 from you every night, but I need that level of dominance from you every night. I can't have a game where you all of a sudden are rolling around with 12 points and relatively like non-existent on the offensive end of the court. If you're an offensive juggernaut, you've got to be an offensive juggernaut every night, because the pull of you is what allows these other people to then work. So when we see it versus Durant, we wonder why we don't get to see it versus the Pistons, or we don't get to see it versus the Pacers. Because the real killers, they kill everybody. They don't care who you are. They kill everybody. And even if you look at his muse and a lot of these guys who coming along now, we have to remember that Tatum is only 23 years old. They're all Kobe Bryant stands. Kobe Bryant didn't care who you were. If you were a star, if you were the last man on the bench, if you were on him, he was trying to give you the work. And so if he just took that, if he's a guy who has fashioned himself as a Kobe Bryant kind of, comes from that Mamba mentality, then we need to see that mentality throughout, not just in games where you get an opportunity to go against the quote unquote best of the best.
Can I talk now?
Absolutely.
I don't disagree with everything you're saying. And I don't. And the part of it that I agree wholeheartedly with is bringing it every night. The nuances that I'd probably want to talk about, one is that you can dominate the game offensively without scoring the ball. So, the fact that Kareem is such a threat down low as the all-time, NBA leading scorer, then can produce open opportunities on the outside for other players. The fact that Bird was such a great passer could make the DJ to Bird to Parrish or McHale a dominant threat. So on any given night, you can put your stamp on the game, and Tatum could put his stamp on those nights that don't have the marquee matchups by simply being the best player on the floor and commanding the kind of attention that requires, and then being a decision maker. So I to me, that's about, you know, attention to detail and about bringing it like you're talking about. But it doesn't have to be 54 is my point.
No,
I don't think we're disagreeing with each other. And then the other thing I would say is, you know, the whole experience of Michael Jordan before they won, right? So when Jackson takes over for Doug Collins and instills the triangle, and, you know, again, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Krzyzewski's memoir, for God's sake, right? I mean, history takes on whatever lessons the publishers wanted to take on, right? Whatever the spin, you know, the public might read. But the bottom line is, now by understanding the triangle and spacing and not just maybe the ISO thing, Kobe thing at its worst, now the team functions at a much higher level. And then on the nights when you need 50, you get 50. But on the nights when it only takes 20, you know, you take your 20, but you know, your impact is elsewhere.
Yep, I would agree. I just don't think they're getting 50 on the nights they need 50. And that's the problem.
Are you talking about, well, who? Tatum?
I'm talking about Tatum.
Well, like, I mean, again, I can only talk about what he did yesterday. So apparently he did. And then you alluded to other nights in marquee matchups and I agree with you, where he's done it. So it seems to me that team's part of that team's maturing process, where they were a 500 team for the last year and a half before this run. Part of that team's maturing process has been about taking every game seriously, not taking professional games lightly. Udoka calling them out early in the year for not being ready at the shoot around. Obviously playing defense, because, you know, that's what sometimes people fail to appreciate sometimes too, that in basketball, both ends of the court are really connected. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it's hard to keep playing defense when you're playing shitty offense, and the ball, or even if you're playing decent offense and the ball's not going in the basket, it's just a hard thing to do to keep playing defense. And likewise, you know, it's hard to play offense when you're taking the ball out of the net every damn possession and the defense is getting themselves back and loaded up against you. So, you know, the only way to, you know, the solution is, okay, we've got to be ready to play complete games every night, which I'm saying is what the Celtics seemingly, and I'm not, again, I'm with them right now as I kind of.
Oh, you're, you know, deep. You're deep. You threw a low-key Jordan comparison in. So
I'm in. But and I think they can get out of the East right now. I think it's them and you know, and they're gonna take down Milwaukee or whatever. So I think they're a real threat in the East. But that's, you know, that there's still a lot of time to go, and injuries, right? Being healthy in the NBA is still rule number one.
Do you think it's interesting that the more everyone keeps telling us the game is different, the game is different, the more they keep looking for a dominant big man?
Well, I mean, that's a profound statement on a lot of levels.
They keep telling us the game's different, but they keep looking for dominant big men.
Right. Because, right? I mean, you just, again, it's a great statement. They keep telling us it's different because then we'll buy it, right? What do you do when something's different a lot of times, particularly if you perceive that it might be better? You buy it. So they keep telling you it's different so that you buy it, you know? Wow, it's different. I'll buy it. But like you said, I mean, hey, look it. From the beginning of time, now, small ball is in, right? But if you want to be an NBA player, it pays to be big. Like, size wins.
I think small ball is simply big men who have an ability to shoot.
Well, sometimes it's but sometimes it also involves smaller, well, at least by old-fashioned standards, more smaller guards or perimeter players that are threats behind the line than, you know, not playing with these combo forwards who can't shoot a 15-footer.
But I feel like those are more out of necessity, because that just gives you the best opportunity to win, right? Yes. Like, I'm playing small ball not because I want to, Like, I'm not going out and actively recruiting
right.
or bringing in free agents to play small ball. I'm doing this right. because I'm the Golden State Warriors, and I can get away with putting Draymond Green at center for 5 and 6 minute stretches because he's tough enough to stay with these guys who are not that dominant anyway. And then I can put another shooter on the, you know, on the court. Whereas if Draymond Green had to deal with Shaq, you would have never seen small ball. Like if he had to deal with Tim Duncan on a regular basis, you would have never seen small ball because they would have murdered Draymond Green for as good as a defensive player as Draymond Green is. And I think he is really talented on the defensive side of the ball. I think he's smart. He understands how to use his body. He was a horrible football player, but that's not here or there. When I think about him in a small ball lineup against an actual legit, let's not even take it to the greats. Let's take it to the very goods. If he had to deal with Sharif Abdul-Rahim, you know, if he had to deal with Marcus Camby, not even just the greats, just the goods, he would have gotten murdered by those guys. Those guys, Rasheed Wallace, who I actually think I have Rasheed Wallace rated higher than a lot of people do, but he would have absolutely murdered some of these dudes. And not because it's like old basketball, new basketball. It's just those guys had a skill set that you can't deal with when you're, you know, 6'4". Charles Barkley couldn't deal with them. And he is the prototype quintessential undersized big man of all time. Well, let me take that back because there's a guy in Boston who was only 6'9" who was really good. So
that's true.
I'll take that back. He's number two.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There's a lot of ways to win, and it's all, you know, like you said. Well, what's the makeup of your team? So you know, would Shaq, you know, what would Shaq, Shaq in his prime? How does he, you know, what happens when he and Giannis go up against each other? You know, Shaq against the Warriors, you know, super team a couple of years back. 40 happens there?
40 plus a night.
Pardon me?
40 plus a night. That's what Shaq's giving all those guys.
Right. But and then the question becomes, you know, obviously, what's he give up? You know, and
that's the $64 million question.
Right. So yeah. But Brewster Academy just yesterday won the prep championship in our level with a team a little bit like what you're talking about. It was a good team, but they had a point guard who was very, very good, but bigger, like at least 6'3", maybe 6'4". You know, very good, very elite player. And then four guys from really 6'7" to 6'10" around them that were all mobile and skilled. And, you know, and as soon as I saw it, and it took a while for them to kind of figure it out. But once they did, you know, they are pretty damn good. And we played them tough in the semifinal. I'm not really looking to get in a ton of detail with that. But I mean, I was pretty proud of the way our guys played, leading the way for 16 or 17 minutes, down 9 at half. Still thought we had a shot, but, you know, ultimately lost the game by 15 or 16. But they cleaned out NMH the next day, who was, clearly those were the top two teams in our league. And Brewster
just jumped all over. Herman, for people who don't know, right?
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And though our league was, you know, those two were above everyone else. I mean, just sheer talent. And then, you know, the other six were pretty even. So. You know, we were happy to get the home game we had. I can't remember if we talked about it or not, but heck, great playoff. Maybe we did. So I'm just stroking ourselves since I can here. Great win at home. Get the Wolverdome jumping and rocking like it felt like it was 2005 all over again. You made a comment about the lob play, for God's sake. That could have been Beasley throwing that lob. So
that was Beasley throwing that lob like five times a game.
Right. Right.
The same play.
Yeah, well, there's no Yeah, and then we actually started the second half of the Brewster games. We were down 9. We hadn't practiced in a while, which is probably my mistake. But we ran the same lob play that we used to run for Alexander Johnson, and then every time we'd have kind of an athletic front court guy out of the so start the ball at halftime to start the second half, and you know, a little catch at the three-point line, a little guard fake handoff, swing the ball to, you know, the other side of the court to a three-point shooter coming off a little staggered screen, but then a little back screen coming back for the big guy. And it looked there. So I was saying, hey, we're going to cut this thing to 7 right away on a momentum play and kind of just energize the whole thing. And we just fumbled the pass at the rim. I mean, it was right there. And
oh,
I
said, wow.
Sugar. Yeah. But yeah. I was, you know, probably my fault for running something we hadn't run, but the guys executed perfectly. And, you know, he just, you know, fumbled the pass. So, but anyway, so again, that lob play was good in 2002. Got it from the Dallas Mavericks. Shout out to Al Lewis, my assistant, who saw it one night. Probably you were with him, for God's sake, late at night.
Not in 02. Not in 02.
No, that's true, I guess. So, and then he, you know, he came into practice and said, hey, listen, here, let's try this. So we've been running it ever since with Keaton Grant and Karan Calhoun, and every time we had any front court guy. But anyway, I digress.
It was good, and congratulations to all the, you know, to all the BA Hoopers and on a great season. Way to finish out strong. It's always important. I know you move into your spring now, and that's important as well. To still work on skill development and all that good stuff like that. So, the grind never stops, as they say. As people
exactly right
continue to go, people continue to
although
go.
You know, speaking of, yeah, the grind never stops, except, you know, I'm channeling my inner Pat Riley when I don't know if his book was Showtime, or it might have been the name of his first book when he won the Lakers, but anyway, the last chapter was always he said, look, by the time you get done with an NBA season, and obviously I can't compare, I'm not going to compare the stress and strain of a prep season to the NBA lifer, but you know, I mean, work is work. So he would say that he and his wife would go to some, you know, Caribbean island or something that day. And so I've always told my wife, like, if in a perfect world, the day our season ended, I'd be off to some deserted island with her and, you know, just kind of decompress for a week or so. So second best thing is go to South Carolina with a couple of buddies that like to golf and do that for 4 or 5 days. So I can't go to a deserted island, but I can go.
When are you heading down to South Carolina?
Wednesday, actually.
And what part of South Carolina? Because that's not that far away.
Is that right? Kiawah Island.
Okay, so if it's an island, it's most likely not that far away. I mean, I'm right on the border of South Carolina near Hilton Head, so.
Okay, well, you know. Probably not. I'll have to look at my GPS.
I'll have to check the GPS on that. See if I come up and you know, swing the club pretty awfully. Once or twice. The it's interesting though, because like the stress can be difficult on a team, especially a team that's favored. You know, if Brewster has everything to lose, nothing to gain, because they're the favorites, right? Similar to South Carolina women's basketball team, who everybody looks at as the favorite, you know, and they just lost in the SEC championship to Kentucky. Now, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think it's still a part of the whole tournament and the way the tournament works. Great for Kentucky. They punch a ticket, you know, to the tournament. I think they were something like 18 or 19 and 11. So, you know, not an awful team, but probably not a team that, you know, is going to be making noise unless they're able to springboard this SEC championship into a run. But man, people are in trouble. Because if it's one thing I know about Dawn Staley, is she is really, really competitive. And now she's going to have just that big of a carrot to dangle over her girl's head to say, hey, listen, we're not champions right now. What are you going to do? The only championship you have to get is this national championship. You can't be SEC championships. No rings for you this year. You know, no SEC tournament champion ring for you this year. The only ring you're getting is this NCAA championship. And man, I would hate to be that team that they face in the first round of the playoffs. I'm predicting a 30 plus point massacre right out the gate for South Carolina.
Yeah, because I mean that's just shameless pandering on your part to Don Staley, who you either A, want to get on this pod, and I know we're going big, so maybe she's out there listening. But I think frankly you're hoping for the pod, but really the pod is then a date afterwards, because I think that's more what this is really all about, is your love affair with Don Staley and not so much about what the Gamecocks got going on. Before we took air, I compared that one to the Duke loss at home to Carolina, and whether or not that would provide Paco Banchero, right? I mean, who's leading the way for Duke. Those guys got to be, same idea where just something, I don't even think Coach K has to be the one holding it over his head. They're going to be playing for something. So I'm moving Duke up a couple notches in my bracket beyond what I might ordinarily, because it's so even. Evenly balanced it, and also because of that emotional factor for Coach K and for the women's side of it, with all due respect, like I watch some, I'm into it. But until more programs, until it becomes across the board, more competitive, then I'm less attuned to it than probably as a basketball person I should be. No disrespect. I just mean, again, Gino's doing what, in my opinion, John Wooden did, 40 years ago. And the next Gino is going to have a harder time to accomplish what he has. And that's not to take anything away from him, because he's an unbelievable coach. Seems like a good, good guy from what I, kind of see and gather. So it's just the state of women's basketball. So 20 years from now, women's basketball is going to be, something way, just like it's way beyond what it was 25 years before now. And it's just going to keep getting better. Then I'll probably pay more attention to what the impact of, a late season loss is. For now,
I think the difference, and yes, the Duke game was a rivalry game, right? But it was still a regular season game. So Duke still has the ACC tournament. So they can possibly exact revenge immediately in the ACC tournament if they cross paths again with North Carolina. We talked about it off air, but I don't think Duke has the same level of dogs as South Carolina's women's team has. And I will say this, I'll give the shout out. I think that there are more teams than there were even maybe 10 years ago in the women's game that are a factor. Because if you think about it, before Don Staley took over at South Carolina, when was South Carolina, a factor? When were they in the talk? There was a time where North Carolina women's basketball was one of the best in the country. Now, not so much. Duke, their women's program, and now they're trying to get it back to where it was after taking the year off and the coaching change, and Kara Lawson over there, who I believe is a fantastic human being and basketball mind over there at Duke. It'll be interesting.
How did she do this year? Because I paid more attention to Kara Lawson when she was an assistant with the Celtics than I did now that she's taken over at Duke.
Yeah. She, I'm not exactly sure what their record is, but I think they're
okay.
We're kind of okay.
And Becky Hammons
took the job with the Las Vegas Aces, and we can get into that another time, because I think it's crazy that they're paying a head coach more than they're paying the players.
Right.
And I'm saying that as a coach. And I like to ride for my people, but I don't understand how that's a model that people think are okay. You're paying head coaches more than you're paying these players that you're selling the game with. It's one of, you know, I that's for another day, but I think Becky Hammon's going to do a great job, but Becky Hammon falls into the same category kind of as those Duke coaches, because she was sitting on the bench of an NBA team and for some, for whatever reason, decided, you know what, I'm done waiting. This is the team I'm going to jump into the women's game on, because she could have had a women's head coaching job forever ago. She could have been a women's head coach years ago, but she sat on that bench learning. The problem is I don't think being a successful head women's basketball coach in the WNBA is going to allow you to transition over to be a successful men's head coach. Like, I don't think you're going to be able to convince the people who make the decisions that that's the way they need to go. Whereas she may have been able to get somebody to apologize for talking, but I think that she may have been able to convince a team to give her the shot as an assistant coach on the men's side. Because we've seen lesser qualified men get head coaching jobs.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's about the convince factor. She not necessarily any different coach. I mean, just like Brad Stevens had to learn the nuances of the NBA and some of that. These are all smart people with unbelievable basketball acumen. So with her experience, she'd be able to jump back into it, but I think it's a harder convince. It'd be similar to the whole, high school and college coaching thing that, many, many years ago, high school coaches would fill the college coaching rosters. And in today's world, that's a lot tougher to, not impossible, but not as many high school football or basketball coaches are jumping right from high school into college. Doesn't mean they can't coach. Not going to convince the AD to take a shot on someone necessarily.
Absolutely.
And shout out to Steve Smith, by the way, who retired at Oak Hill. We had gone down there a couple times in my time, but talk about runs and talk about someone who stayed at a place. Larry Davis, who claimed to fame at Furman and had been an assistant at Minnesota and a lot of places, had kind of got that thing going in the late 70s. And Steve Smith took over for him in the early 80s. And you just figured, okay, Martha Wilson, Virginia, he won't be there forever. But wrong again, he just knocked it out of the park. So hats off to Steve Smith if he's listening.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the job well done. Thank you for your service, Coach Smith. We know that coaching, regardless of what level it is and how much you're being paid, is a labor of love, because you're never going to be fully appreciated the way you should. But we want all coaches to know that we appreciate them, what they do and what they bring to the game. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our time for today. This has been the Zebra Stripes Podcast, episode 13. Is that the first time we're saying that today, Whit?
It is. I'll be honest with you, I thought it was 14, but because last time it was, I thought 13 for sure, but maybe it was 12 for sure.
It was 12 for sure, and I know it's 12 for sure because I'm sitting here looking at where I actually upload all of these things at. So this is episode 13.
Yeah, and you got me already thinking ahead. I'm excited about what's ahead for us.
Absolutely.
And I'm excited for you that it's your birthday. And we have a tradition in our house that, we don't always have to celebrate birthdays on the day that they were actually conceived. So we sometimes celebrate birthdays whenever the hell we want to celebrate a birthday. So we're going to celebrate Gene Clements' birthday in my house today or next week or next month.
Or whenever. Yeah. Hopefully maybe like April 1st or something like that. Who knows?
Exactly. Put some
things into the air. Again, make sure that you're following us wherever you follow podcasts. We're on more and more platforms daily. So look out for the Zebra Stripes Podcast. Wherever you like to get your podcast, you definitely can find us on Spotify. So make sure that you follow us there. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, be blessed. Have a good one.